Gay Wizard Book Club.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Gay Wizard Book Club, where we book wizards and club. Nope. Should have thought that through. I'm Paul W. Turing.
I'm Ray McLean.
And we're discussing chapters 3 and 4 of The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins.
Yeah. How's it going this week, Paul?
Pretty good. Just working overtime and watching so much sci-fi TV. All of it.
Good.
Yeah. How about you?
It's good. You know, I'm a little hungover, but I'm here. Good. Go team. I got my fruit punch flavored Gatorade with me, so, you know.
Nice.
That will cancel it out.
I've had 3 cups of coffee, 2 of them cold. And yeah, and just a lot of water. Yeah, I stayed over at Joe's Lake House Sitting, an extremely suburban house in extreme suburbs. And it's really empty. It's really weird. They just have like a lot of space and no furniture. They have furniture, but it just seems very... I'm so used to living in tiny apartments that I overstuff with furniture.
Yeah.
And these are just not kitschy people. So it's very strange.
Yeah.
But we just like purposefully turned up the TV really loud because like we're in a house and there's no, you know, like there's no
nobody
one on the other
tell
side.
Tell you
of the
to
wall.
Turn it down.
Yeah. So we just watched. What did we watch? We watched something very loudly and yelled about it.
That's good.
Yeah. No, it was good.
Amazing. Cool. You want to get into it?
Yeah, let's get into this.
All right. So here's our summary for Chapter 3. After the reaping, Katniss and Peeta are marched into the Justice Building by peacekeepers and sent to separate rooms where they say goodbye to their loved ones. Katniss has 4 sets of visitors. Her mother and Prim come first. Next, Peeta's father gives Katniss a packet of cookies and a promise to look out for Prim. Third, Madge gives Katniss her Mockingjay pin as her district token to wear in the arena. Finally, Gale gives Katniss comfort, practical reassurance, and a possibly sexy hug. Katniss and Peeta are taken to a luxurious train that spirits them away from District 12 toward the capital. Haymitch cuts their first dinner short by showing up, throwing up, and passing out. All right.
Very, very nice description.
Thank you.
Because that's, yeah, especially the possibly sexy kiss. Because that's exactly how I felt about it. You're like, is this sexy? If you want it to be, it is, reader.
It's truly, truly the reader's choice.
I mean, Gale's definitely sexy. Like, that's not really up for debate.
That is 100%. Only evidence in the text for Gale being sexy.
But yeah, okay, so yeah, it starts off right away, they're taken into custody.
Mm-hmm.
No handcuffs or anything, because there's just absolutely nowhere for them to go.
Yeah.
And it's the anthem playing part kind of creeped me out this time, because again, it just calls attention to how much of this is just like a sporting event. It's just, it's Super Bowl season, and, like, that's all that's happening. And District 12 took a knee, you know? Like, they...
Oh, my God. They so did, though. So, they get taken to, like, wait in these rooms in the Justice Building, and Katniss is noting that this is, like, the fanciest room she's ever been in.
Yeah.
And she's sitting on a velvet couch. But, I think that part of writing a really tight novel is being your own, like, picky reader.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a good moment, because, like, as soon as she says she's sitting on a velvet couch, she's like, well, my mom has a nice dress from back when she had money with a velvet collar, so that's how I know what that is. Because, like, that is the moment where, as a picky reader, you're like, ugh, she's only lived on homespun. How does she know what velvet is?
Right.
And, like... Suzanne is just right there to just, like, close those loopholes before they even happen, which I appreciate.
Well, and it's such a, like, further proof that it's a good strategy is that not only does she prevent anyone from being a picky reader, she's also, well, I hadn't thought of it that way, as, like, from the editing perspective of, like, she's looking for things that would seem out of place, but what it actually ends up doing is further establishing a character rather than pointing out a hole in a character. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it, mm-hmm. it just, like, reinforces her background and all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's already thinking to herself about how crying is not an option. Because this awareness that becomes an increasing thing as the book goes on, especially in this part, how much the fact that everything is a performance and everything has to be evaluated in that lens of, like, knowing that everything you do could affect getting sponsors and therefore surviving the games. Although it's also sort of a character building moment, because later on, like, you know, she theorizes about, because PETA shows emotion and is crying and, like,
oh yeah, we're gonna talk about that.
We are gonna talk about that. But she thinks about how maybe he's playing the cameras by, like, either, you know, trying to gain sympathy or, like, sort of hustling the other tributes by making himself look weak to surprise them later. And so clearly there are other strategies other than not crying and shoving your emotions down. But, like, well, it's a strategy that's worked for Katniss so far.
I was about to say, Katniss is employing the Paul and Ray, I mean the pushing your emotions down strategy.
Shut up. But it's also very much Katniss's strategy all through life. 100%. Just, like, be like, well, yeah, this obviously that's the option she chooses in this moment.
Yeah.
And she says goodbye to her mom and Prim, which becomes mostly about, like, how what they'll need to know to survive without her.
Yeah. I was reading that and my notes just say Katniss is a femtop. And that is why she wins the Hunger Games and brings down an entire society.
She takes care of business. She brings home the bacon.
She sure does.
And there's a moment where, talking about sort of mental illness, and how Katniss doesn't really have time for that.
Well, yeah, where she talks about her mom being, like, catatonically depressed about, like, maybe it's a sickness, but it's a sickness we can't afford.
Yeah.
That's brutal.
Yeah. Going back a bit, there's a moment where, you know, she's thinking to herself, like, Gail will take care of them. Mm-hmm. Even before Gail gets into the room and, like, says that, she's kind of assuming that. But there's a little aside where, like, she mentions that her and Gail made a pact about that about a year ago. And it made me think of, like, a moment before last Reaping Day where they were, like, having similar anxieties, and that's the conversation that they had and the agreement that they made.
Totally. As I was reading this chapter and, like, this whole series of visitors she has in the Justice Building, this is a really good example of a series of scenes that are, like, really cool and interesting and important and, like, were cut out of the movie and should be cut out of the movie because it's, like, detail where, like, a lot of people are talking. You know, it's like how all of the various weird challenges got cut out of the maze in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire movie. Yeah. Even though, like, they should have kept that Sphinx if only for the absolutely dreadful mid-2000s CGI that no doubt would have happened.
It would have been terrible.
And, like, also almost certainly racist, you know?
Yes. Yeah. No, a black woman definitely would have played that Sphinx.
I don't know, but, like, whatever the choice was, it would have been bananas.
It would not have been good.
But just, like, I don't know. This is, like, a bunch of little things happening that is an example of why, like, books are a great medium and stand out on their own. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's interesting that, well, I don't know if it's particularly interesting that Prim brings it up, but it is the first suggestion here that Katniss actually has a chance of winning. you know, and Katniss brushes that off because she's thinking of the careers. Well, it's interesting that, like, she brushes it off internally, but then out loud says maybe, because she, like, well, I can't, I just told my mom that she can't break down again, so I guess I can't say that and then tell her that I've given up right away. Mm-hmm. Which shows how not a fan Katniss is of, like, being hypocritical. And she, you know, like, she believes in principles and sticking to them, and, like, really disrespects people who don't stick to the principles that they say they believe in, which comes up way later. Like, I'm thinking, like, book three and the leader of District 13. I can't remember her name.
Gray eyes lady.
Yeah. But just, like, because she's a person who, like, I, like, Katniss, I think, goes through a journey with her of, like, she speaks of principles and then kind of betrays those to Katniss. So just kind of establishing that character trait early on for her.
Totally. So next we get Peeta's dad comes and visits Katniss, and, like, he doesn't say anything until, like, the very, very end of the interaction, when he's like, I'll, you know, I'll make sure Prim's eating, basically. What is it with this book and silent parents? And what is it with this book and silent but, like, benign fathers?
Yeah. Well, and he's, like, the nicer one of Peeta's parents, but also, like, the submissive one of the two. Which, there's a lot going on with parents in this book. But I do love the relief Katniss feels at hearing that, that he's going to make sure Prim doesn't starve. Which, of course, her lack of, she just is like, well, everyone likes Prim, that must be why. And it's like, no, Katniss, you're pretty awesome, too. Like, this is also about you.
Yeah, Katniss does not know that. Katniss knows that 0%.
She knows that absolutely none at all. But it is a nice, the moment of relief she feels is always sticks with me. Mm-hmm. And then there's Madge. Who gives the Mockingjay pin, which, of course, becomes a huge symbol throughout this series. And it's kind of already a symbol, because we get this history of the previous, the war rebellion that started the Hunger Games 70 years ago, and how the Capitol made the Jabberjays, which were, like, genetic mutation creations that could, like, record conversations, which is cool and terrifying.
Totally.
There's a moment when she's talking about him and she's like, it took the rebels a while to figure out how their intel was getting back to the Capitol. I'm like, yeah, fucking bet. I bet it took a while to figure that out, because, like, how do you figure that out? How do you put those together? You're like, I just can't imagine the circumstances that led to some genius being like, oh my god, there's always a bird nearby when these people are having these conversations. Holy fuck. Like, did the Capitol do this? You know, like, how do you... That's not... You'd have just put one and one together to get two on that. Like...
Yeah. No, it's true.
But yeah, so, which, of course, they, the male Jabberjays bred with mockingbirds and became Mockingjays. And so it's a symbol of how the rebels used a weapon of the Capitol against them, because they started feeding false information to the Jabberjays. So it already carries that symbolism, but Katniss carries it with her, we see later on, because to her it's a symbol of her father. To her, it reminds her of the times that her and her father would go into the woods and he had this beautiful singing voice and the Mockingjays would listen and repeat his songs, because they only do that with people who have good voices, I guess. So it further establishes that, like, Katniss has a lot of obstinate character traits, but she's not, like, a rebel. You know, like, she chooses this because of her intimate connections with her family, and, like, all of her decisions throughout this series are much are directly motivated by her immediate emotional connections with the people close to her. You know, she's usually not thinking that big.
Yeah. Yeah, Katniss gives her this pin and then gives her a possibly sexy kiss on the cheek. And Katniss is like, oh my God, wait. Have we been friends this whole time?
Oh, Katniss.
Which I just love that.
I do, yeah.
Poor sweet Katniss.
They had no idea. It's like, yeah, no, she's just been your silent friend this whole time.
This whole time.
It's also kind of the first example. I mean, her and the fact that that Madge and the Baker come to see her are kind of the first examples of, like, people seeing Katniss as something special and something big, even though she doesn't see it in herself yet. We're like, they don't really, I mean, Madge knows her, you know, but, like, these people didn't have to do this, you know, there's no, like, obligation for them to come see her, but they kind of already believe in her, you know, they already,
yeah.
At this point, it's just, like, they believe in her as a victor. It's not anything bigger than that at this point, but it's the beginning of that, you know? And then Gail visits.
And, like, we get an amazing whiplash paragraph where Katniss is like, there is nothing, I repeat, nothing romantic between us. But then we hug, and for a long time, and I smell him, and I can feel his, I'm quoting here, lean and hard-muscled body against my own. Yeah. Which is like, I don't know, Katniss. That sounds sexy.
It sounds sexy. It's true. I keep going back and forth on this, like, whether this friendship is romantic or not. I mean, like,
so
it's certainly romantic from Gail's side. Because, like, the fact that they've been best friends this whole time, and this is the first time they've hugged. Like, if you have if you have a hot friend that you never have any physical contact with, like, ever... something's going on. Like,
I was about to be like, well, I never touch any of my friends because I hate touching. And that is true. I also, like, made out with most of them as a teenager. So I, like Katniss, I don't know.
Right, but, like, even if you're another kind of person to initiate that, but, like, people hug you, you know, like,
yeah.
And you go along with it because it's not weird.
Yes.
Like, no one between these two people has initiated a hug ever, which seems to be the implication here. So, like, that's something.
Yes.
Yeah, so they have a totally platonic hug. And then, and Gail's immediately like, you get a knife. Like, Gail's immediately like, you gotta win this, you can win this, Katniss, you can kill people. They're just, Gail's thinking ahead as he does.
I like that because it was like Katniss kind of comforted her, or was trying to comfort her mom and sister, in the exact same way that Gail is, like, trying to comfort her now.
Hmm.
Of, like, here are these practical things you can do. And it's, like, they really, like, think the same way and try to, like, care for people in the same way. And that's nice.
Yeah, that's true. And it's sort of, like, Katniss goes along with the idea that maybe she could win in order to comfort Prim and her mom. But, like, Gail really believes it. And, like, Gail gets her thinking about it in a real way. And in a way that it's, like, almost a possibility for her, which she hadn't on her own. Like, she hadn't gotten there on her own, you know?
Yeah. Also, this, like, interspersed in this conversation with Gail is just some really bananas horrifying exposition about what some of the other Hunger Games have been like.
Yeah.
You know, like, where she's like, I hope I can get a knife, and casually is like, I don't know, one year they only had spiked maces and all the children had to beat each other to death. You know? He's like, you gotta find some wood, you know, you can do that. And she's like, you know, yeah, they have been putting wood in the arena since that year that half the children just died of exposure and it was unpopular because it was bad TV.
Yeah.
It's, whoa. Yeah,
it's really just casually dropped in there. That stuff is crazy. Especially the fire part. Like, well, they usually have to have wood, so we can at least have a fire not to die around. And then they get driven to the train station, which Katniss has never been in a car before. She's barely even ridden in a wagon, which is crazy. And when seeing... I just love that when she gets there and sees the cameras everywhere, her first thought is, I've been right not to cry.
Yeah. So Katniss is going to stay on brand this entire time.
Yep. And she looks at herself in the TV and feels gratified that she looks almost bored, which, yeah, I can relate, Katniss.
Yeah, 100%.
My old boss at my old job, he's really nice, but he has a tendency of saying kind of tactless things when he's not meaning to insult you, but he'll just, like, say something about you that, like, isn't really a compliment. And one time he was talking to me and he's like, well, you know how, like, you kind of often have, like, fuck off written on your face.
Wow.
And I was just like, well, the 17-year-old in me is very satisfied to hear that. I don't know how great that is overall.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow. So, yeah, Katniss is glad that she's, like, looking really unemotional. She looks over and you can, like, she can clearly tell that Peeta's been crying. And I just love this, like, character disparity where Katniss is like, what five-dimensional chess is he playing? And Peeta is literally just, like, letting himself have feelings and doing fit his life.
That is
this whole book.
Yes. That's true. It is the whole book. I kept thinking about that in both of these chapters of, like Katniss is constantly analyzing Peeta for ulterior motives, which, like, I keep wanting to be like, who hurt you, Katniss? But, like, everyone hurt you.
It was everyone.
But, like, yeah, Peeta's literally just, like, living his life. There's, like, one time in these two chapters that he's actually kind of thinking strategically, and it's, like, when he's waving at the people out the train window.
Yeah.
And that's the only time. But she is constantly suspicious of him.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great.
Well, and she sees how, like, speaking of sexy bodies, she notices that he's, like, strong and broad-shouldered, and, but of course, like, all that makes her think is that, like, how well-fed he's been, you know, his whole life, and how privileged he is.
Yeah, I definitely was thinking about how, like, I like how this book, like, the different, like, child competitors, she really makes a point of talking about how, like, nutrition has affected them.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, that would not have played well on screen. I am not surprised that Hollywood cut that out of the movie. That's too upsetting.
Yeah.
For, like, a PG-13 blockbuster movie. And that's why Ender's Game was a bad movie. It's only too upsetting. The whole book is too upsetting.
Yeah, no, I don't even want to talk about the Ender's Game movie. It just makes me so angry.
What movie? Yeah.
Everything about it is bad, and it also just shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and it wouldn't have been a good look for them to make a bunch of child actors look malnourished on screen, you know? Probably just wouldn't have played well.
It would have been bad TV, like, when all of those children died of exposure. Oh, dear.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
So we get, like, a description of when Katniss is, like, clearly Peeta's a strategic genius, and he's only pretending to be weak. But she talks about a girl, Joanna Mason, from District 7, who is a victor, and, like, pretended to be weak until she murdered a lot of other kids.
until she, like, went full Here's Johnny. Because, like, isn't an axe her main weapon?
Yeah, she Lizzie Borden'd everyone. And, like, I just imagine child... Like, yeah, we get to see her in Book 7. And she's, like, an axe-wielding...
Lumberjack.
Just, lumber... Hot, hot. I mean,
sexy,
yeah.
Terrifying, dramatic. Yeah. Some real Killing Eve vibes.
Truly the dream.
Her.
Wow, yeah. But, like, I love the idea of, like, 15-year-old Joanna Mason pretending to be, like, cowardly and sniffling.
Yes.
And, like, that would have been just such a great reveal.
Yeah, no, I'd watch that. I'd watch that Hunger Games.
That was a good season.
It's like an anthology TV show, but the actors die.
Yeah.
And of course, we get some more horrific background about how no one even gets to travel on train if you're from the districts, unless you're like, That's part of your job, because you're moving coal, because that's the only thing they get to do, is touch and move coal. And even, like, all their education, she goes on a tangent about how, like, literally everything about their life is about coal, especially their education, where beyond, like, basic math and reading, which I'm frankly shocked they learn that.
Yeah.
They only learn about, like, the science of coal, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, like, you know, some, quote, history, quote, in their history class. And I just thought to myself, huh, I wonder what it's like to live in a society where the only history you learn in grade school is just propaganda that makes your country sound amazing.
Yeah, I wonder what that would be like. Yeah.
Which Katniss ends that passage being like, whatever the truth is, I don't see how it will help me get food on the table. Because Katniss is on brand at all times.
Yes. We get, like, explicit confirmation during this that District 12 is Appalachia and the capital is in the Rocky Mountains.
Yes. And that the mountains protected the capital in the previous war. And then this train, which is just, like, it's a train, and it's by miles the most luxurious place she's ever seen or heard of or been in. It's better than the Justice Building, which is, like, the capital building of her district.
Yeah.
Like, she has a private room with, like, a walk-in closet and her own bathroom. And, like, she's never taken a hot shower before. She's never taken a shower before. She's never seen hot water that she didn't have to boil herself. So, very different lifestyle. She gets dressed after her shower, and she finally takes a closer look at the Mockingjay pen, which is when we get more info about it. And we already talked about it, but I just want to, like, comment on her. Just this author is such a good writer, where, like, this description is delayed, and it doesn't feel weird at all. It's actually the perfect time for this description, because, like, getting it earlier in the scene where she gets it from Madge would have made the pacing feel weird and, like, would have taken us out of what was happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just good. She's a good writer.
Yeah, she has a good sense of when to flashback. Yeah, so in this exposition, we get introduced to the, like, genetically engineered weapon animals of the capital that they called mutations, or mutts for short, which is like, yeah, give the people what they want. Give me genetically engineered weapon animals.
It's fantastic.
I love that so much. I, like, the more mutts, the better, honestly. I also was reading this of, like, where they only bred male Jabberjays. And, like, in my head, it was just Jeff Goldblum's voice being like, nature always finds a way.
Yeah, the biology of that raises a question mark, but it's delightful.
It's wonderful. I also like that, like, there's a lot of, like, subtle implication that Jabberjays are a little bit more aware and thinking and feeling than regular animals, you know, where they talk about, like, they would sing back to you if they liked you, or, like, when Katniss's dad is singing to them, they would mimic him after a polite pause, and, like, then not everybody was treated with such respect. But that, like, they're, like, Harry Potter owl level intelligence.
The Mockingjays, yeah.
Yeah, and I just thought that was, like, a cool and interesting implication that, like, the Mutts and their descendants are, like, a little bit more aware and interactive in, like, a human compatible way.
I love a smart little bird. Just, like, mm-hmm. I keep seeing posts on Tumblr about people telling stories about how they accidentally made friends with, like, your local crows, or, like, you know, or, like, they gave, like, a cool trinket to a raven once, and then that raven later defended them in a random alley attack from a scary cat, you know, like...
The raven, like, was yes. there, like, Batman in that moment.
I read a great story, I think it was in Oregon, of someone who, like, her neighborhood was, like, full of crows, and she started, like, feeding them or whatever, and then she couldn't, like, people... It started becoming a problem because whenever, like, one of her neighbors would approach her on the street, the crows would start attacking that neighbor because they just assumed that that neighbor was an enemy and was, like, trying to hurt their pet human. So, like, the whole neighborhood had to start feeding the crows to, like, join the gang.
Oh, my God. Because, like, would there be anything scarier than crows solidarity attacking you?
No. And apparently those people are right. Those crows are ride or die. Based on all the stories I've heard, you win a crow over, you have their loyalty for life. Which, like,
it's amazing.
Gotta find me some crows. Sounds fun.
Hell yeah. Familiar.
Exactly. So then it's dinner time, and continuing to be excessively on brand, Katniss walks in, and she describes the walls as, like, paneled, and she describes the dishes as highly breakable.
Yes.
Which tells you...
Yeah, she's like, if you got all this money, why can't you make a bulletproof dish?
Well, I just love the, like, that's her perspective of just, like, it's not that they're fancy. She's like, it's so fucking dumb that they have all this break. We're on a train. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. She's great.
And then there's a horrible moment where Effie remarks on how they actually have decent table manners and don't eat like savages like the last tributes did from last year.
Mm-hmm.
And then Katniss just says fuck you and eats with her hands just to say fuck you, which love that.
Yeah, and wipes her hands on the tablecloth.
Yeah. Well, and she makes, a lovely point to mention. It's like, I only know how to use a knife and fork because my mom, who grew up in the, like, middle class, taught me how to do that. Like, if it weren't for her mom, she wouldn't know how to even use a knife or fork.
Yeah. And then, Haymitch shows up, and he is, like, fully blacked out. And he's like, did I miss dinner? And then he throws up and passes out in his own vomit. And, like, whoa.
Yeah, the Haymitch in the end of this chapter and beginning of next is, like, a little too gross. It's very real.
I do like that it's that it's real rough. Because, like, if you were alcoholic... And your job was coaching children to be murdered once a year. Yeah, you would black out on reaping day. Just, that makes sense.
Fully, all the way. Right after, he appears, right after they are forced to watch all the other reapings. Including their own, which, like, just begins the horrible journey of having to watch themselves on TV all the time in this horrible context and having to be so, like, it's bad enough having to see yourself on screen or listen to your voice recorded under, like, light circumstances. Can you imagine, like, being judgmental of yourself with the added like, cherry on top of, like, if I don't seem cool and hot, no one will prevent me from dying in this bloodbath.
Yeah.
Like, it's cool. But yeah, we get introduced to some of the main tributes that come up later, like the monstrous boy from District 2, Foxface, a crippled boy from District 10, and as we later learn, Rue from District 11, who is 12 and reminds Katniss of Prim. And then the commentators make a bunch of dismissive remarks about how cool District 12 is.
You got anything else for Chapter 3?
Nope. Let's move right along.
All right. So in Chapter 4, Katniss and Peeta help Haymitch back to his compartment. Peeta volunteers to put Haymitch to bed. Confronted again with Peeta's genuine kindness, Katniss decides to have as little contact as possible with him because feelings are scary. As the train speeds along, Katniss reflects on learning to hunt and gather during her childhood and the traumatic experience of her mother's depressive episode. Over breakfast, Peeta and Katniss convince Haymitch to coach them in exchange for a promise that they won't interfere with his drinking. After emerging from a tunnel through the Rocky Mountains, they arrive in the Technicolor fever dream of wealth that is Pan Am's capital.
Nice. So Haymitch is gross, and Katniss is just completely thrown by the revelation that Peeta's just nice.
Yeah. And then I love, so yeah, they like help him, like, Haymitch back to his compartment and, you know, start kind of like showering him down, and Peeta's like, I can take it from here, like, you're good, you don't have to do this. And Katniss is like, wow, thank you. And she, as she's walking back to her compartment, she's like, oh my god, was he just being nice? And she like gets really salty about it and takes the like precious priceless packet of cookies from his dad and throws it out the window and then backfires hilariously. It falls on a dandelion, and it just reminds her of like this, that like formative memory of Peeta giving her the bread, and she's like, fuck, I wanted to forget how nice you are. I just love that.
Really just twisted the knife as she like remembers how even more significant that scene was, because like it's followed by a reminiscence of how her and Prim went and harvested a bunch of dandelions and like made a dandelion salad. That part's hilarious.
So funny.
And I love the detail of Katniss being like, I really don't want to wash vomit out of this man's chest hair. Like, that particular detail is delightfully effective.
I also made note of that detail because truly nothing sounds worse.
No. No. Oh, that sounds terrible. Yeah, so we get a flashback backstory montage, is how I labeled it in my notes.
100%.
Where Katniss, you know, kind of spurred by the dandelion moment, remembers that day and how started venturing into the woods. She killed her first rabbit. And there's this weird moment where it, like, seeing the rabbit stirs something in her mom, and her mom like wakes up just enough to like skin the rabbit and cook it into a stew, but then like goes right back to sleep. And they have to like feed her the stew.
Yeah, that is, I also made note of just how like heartbreaking that detail is.
Yeah, it's a pretty realistic portrayal, I think, of depression. How it comes and goes like that, and speaking of terrifying details, she talks about on her birthday, when she finally turns 12 on May 8th, she brings the Tesseroy home in a toy wagon.
Oh my god. Yeah.
Just that picturing, is like a little red wagon.
So sad. That is really brutal. Oh my god.
I don't know, anything that, like, stood out in this sort of montage that you want to talk about?
You know, not really. The next thing I really took note of was where she's thinking about, like, could Gale and me have really only been eating blackberries this morning? Like, that seems like a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
And it was making me think about, so, in real life, I work in a deli. And I've been there for, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 months. And this deli has a sandwich of the month. And so far in my time there, we have had, like, 3 sandwiches of the month. And they have never switched over on the first. And I feel like the sandwiches of the month are the best measure of pandemic time I can give.
We're like, it's been 7 calendar months, but only 3 sandwich months of COVID and, like, time. Yeah.
And, like, the sandwich months have been maybe, like, 4 months, 1.5 months, and now just ongoing.
Yeah. Yep. Yes, I also, that moment also made me think of real life and how, like, yeah, mm-hmm. yep. Time and trauma is whatever it wants to be, and you never know.
Not trauma time is a straw, and trauma time is a crazy straw. It is just, yeah.
It's the Jeremy Bear-me, for all you Good Place fans out there. I do like the moment of when she's talking about how, you know, as Katniss became more confident in the woods, and it became more of a routine, and they started to, you know, survive and live. Mm-hmm. How her mother slowly returned from her depression. Mm-hmm. And it's a moment of, like, a real self-awareness for Katniss, where it's clear that she's very aware of the problems in her relationship with her mother and where it's coming from. And she has this moment of sadness where, you know, she knows she's probably going to her death, and, like, the last moment was her kind of yelling at her mom to get her shit together. It just stuck out to me as that sort of almost uncharacteristic self-awareness for Katniss, because, like any 16-year-old, she's not particularly self-aware.
Yeah, but she is, like, thinking about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know how she could possibly fix that relationship, but, like, she knows she wants to, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then she goes to bed, mm-hmm. knows it's a good time to cry, but can't, and feel that, girl.
Yeah. Hard relate. Yeah. I also read that paragraph and was like, ooh, that's a little close to home.
I always get into this weird cycle where, like, the cry will start, mm-hmm. and then I'll get so excited that it's finally happening that I, like, like prevent it from getting to anywhere real and helpful. Somehow we're like, and then I get slightly mad at myself because it's like, damn it, Paul, that could have been a great cry. But it almost never gets beyond, like, a few tears, maybe 1 second of cringe face, you know? Like,
yeah. That's amazing.
And then it's the next morning.
Mm-hmm. I really like where Effie wakes her up and is like, it's gonna be a big day! Wake up, sleepyhead! And Katniss is just sitting there in her, like, bed that's taking her to the Murder Olympics, being like, what does Effie think about during the day? Like, I could never guess. I'll never know.
That moment is so hilarious and also, like, so significant. Because on the one hand, you're like, yeah, that's actually a really, really important moment in, like, class difference, where, like, imagining what Effie thinks about living in, like, a developed, what we think of as, like, a developed first world society for Katniss, it's unimaginable what Effie, it's literally unimaginable what Effie thinks about and what she worries about.
Yeah.
But it's also so funny because you can so perfectly picture, like, Katniss is laying in bed and she just angrily opens her eyes while, like, while Effie's, like, banging on the door, like, come on, time to get ready for the morning. And you just imagine the, like, fuck off written on Katniss's face in that moment.
It's so true. Oh, yeah. Man. Yeah, this is just, like, the most relatable page of all time, because then, like, she's just like, I have no fucking clue what Effie thinks about. She, like, swings her legs out of bed, like, oh, God, it's gonna be another day, and just looks at the clothes that she left on the floor last night and is like, they're fine.
Good, they're
puts
good
them
enough.
Back
they're
on.
They're a little wrinkly. Yeah.
Which, my...
And her hair, too. Like, your hair's like, eh, I styled it yesterday. It's fine.
Yeah. That's...
no one looks at the back anyways.
It's true. Yeah, it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah. And we get a horrible glimpse of the potential disaster that could be having a shitty stylist.
Yes.
Because she's like, meh. I hope nudity isn't going to be a huge thing, and, like, she just has no control over that. That's cool.
Yeah, and, like, that's good that these children who murder each other are also definitely sexualized. That's good to hear.
That has been, like, a real thought that, like, has been starting at this point in the chapter and going on of just, like, Yeah, attractiveness is a huge thing that's talked about with these tributes, mm-hmm. and they are children. Like,
they are.
She's 16, kids. Which almost makes it slightly less gross, but, like, so many of these kids are 12 and 13 and 14. And
yeah. It's not good.
It's really not good. Oh, man. So then there's the breakfast scene. Let's yeah. talk about that.
So I do first want to say that she points out that they have orange juice, coffee, and hot chocolate. Multiple beverages is the ultimate sign of opulence. Just, like, having three drinks available to you. Like, at that yep. point, if I'm, like, at brunch or something, I'm like, this is it. This is what it feels like. I'm making it.
It's very true. It's, like, the classic thing you see in, like, TV and movies. Also, it makes me think of, there's this hilarious, meme isn't exactly the right word, but it's this collection of photographs that I've seen a couple times, and it's a bunch of, like, stock photos, advertisements for, like, those things that you put in the bathtub that, like, creates a little table for you in your bathtub. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's like all the marketing photos, and every marketing photo, it's like a sexy woman who's mm-hmm. not at all wet laying in a bathtub and on her little, like, tray table is, like, the most hilarious collection of things that no real woman would ever have. It's, yes. like, an iPad, two iPhones, a glass of red wine, a glass of white wine, and a cup of tea, and white grapes, and green grapes that are, like, not in a container of any kind, and, like, also some cheese. You know, like, it's always, like,
yeah.
and, like, they were all just wow. varying combinations of that, of, like, and, like, at first glance, you don't notice anything, but as soon as someone points it out, you're like, yeah, why does this lady have three glasses of wine and no bottle anywhere near her? You know, like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. So here's a question, Paul. What would be on your little bathtub thing, IRL?
Oh, I mean, like, in my dream or in real life? Because, like, in my dream, it's, like, a glass of red wine mm-hmm. and also, like, a cappuccino
mm-hmm.
and, like, a bowl of mac and cheese and a bong mm-hmm. and then, like, also there's a sexy six pack in the bathtub with me, you know, like a
yeah.
just like a sexy muscly boy in there.
Wow. Oh my God, that was like a thousand times better than what I was gonna say. laptop that is almost electrocuting me.
Yeah, well, I went with dream, not reality. Reality would be like me, a cut open bag of like baking chocolate chips, because that's the only chocolate I have in the house, you know? And yes, yeah. Like my phone being propped up by a cup of cold coffee that I'm watching, that I'm rewatching Gilmore Girls on alone. That's yeah. the real one.
Yeah. Oh my God. Okay.
So breakfast.
We're at breakfast. All right. So Haymitch is having some hair of the dog.
Yeah. Effie's already pissed. I just love that Katniss walks in the room and Effie's already pissed. Love that detail.
Until this Hunger Games, I feel like Effie has just been in a constant state of anger in her job.
Yeah, she does not like her job, and she really does not like Haymitch.
Yeah.
And yeah, the orange juice detail is so, so great and so real. Yes. She's like, wow, they use their oranges for juice. I've literally only ever had an orange once as a very expensive treat on New Year's. Like, mm-hmm. And then her and PETA just eat way too much food, because
yeah.
you would.
Yeah, I really am glad that this book is called The Hunger Games, and, like, that that's what the event is called, because, like, this book is so interested in food and hunger and starvation and binging, and, like, it's a really, like, powerful current, especially in this book, but through the whole series, and, like, I'm glad that the author and whoever else decided the title was like, yeah, let's make it obvious.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's very much like the whole kind of argument and Katniss's journey throughout the series of sort of like discovering who the real enemy is. Mm-hmm. It's all her navigating class differences, varying levels of class differences. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's immediately brought out that that's what this is about. Yeah. Right in the title, right in, yeah, all this discussion about food scarcity and yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that Katniss immediately decides that she hates Haymitch.
Yeah.
She's like, I fucking hate this guy.
This guy sucks.
Oh, he has a debilitating mental illness? Fucking shit's weak.
I know, it's so true. Because Haymitch is like, my reaction to Haymitch is I'm just like, oh my God, that poor man. You know?
Yeah. But not Katniss. No, Katniss.
Not Katniss. There's
no time for that shit.
She, yeah. Haymitch, a person? Absolutely not.
Yeah. And then we just get some badassness. Just some badass moments of badassness.
Yeah. It rules.
PETA and Katniss, they lash out at Haymitch because he's being a dick. Mm-hmm. And PETA, like, throws his Bloody Mary across the train.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
And gets a punch in the face for it. And Katniss, like... Mm-hmm. Totally on purpose and definitely not actually just missing his hand, stabs a knife in between his fingers on the table.
Yeah, and Haymitch kind of, like, sits up at this and looks around and is like, I can work with this.
Yeah. It's such a movie moment of, yeah. It's just such a movie moment. Haymitch, you could just totally see the look in his face of just like, alrighty then.
Yeah. I've got a live pair. Yeah.
Totally. the moment where Katniss throws a knife and it just happens to land between the two panels, and she's like, well, that made me look awesome.
Yeah, and like, yeah, Katniss, it made you look awesome.
It made you look hot as fuck.
Truly.
And Amy's just like, no, 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 keep the bruise. It'll make you look badass.
Yeah, after he punches PETA and PETA like starts to ice it, Amy's just like, no, no, no. Which is great, and is also a good early sign that, like, Haymitch is, you know, crushed by his addiction and terrible life circumstance, but he is, like, smart and a fighter, and he, like, won for a reason, you know?
Right. And that he's been, like, he has been learning this whole time, all these years mm-hmm. as a mentor. It's like he's been keeping an eye open and learning the strategies, and I always imagine his backstory, and maybe we get more of this in actual detail at some point, I can't remember, but...
I don't know.
As, like, you gotta imagine, like, the first couple times, he tried really hard with all of them, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just years of trying and failing, where he just gave up hope. And mm-hmm. this is the first time in a long time that he's had a semblance of hope around his tributes.
Yeah.
But yeah, that he, like you said, yeah, he's smart. He is ready to play the game. He just hasn't been playing for a while.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's interesting where, like, you know, they agree, they make this deal where he's like, don't interfere with my drinking and I'll be like functional enough to help you, which is like, yeah, if they stopped him drinking, he would die in like 2 days.
No.
I mean, yeah. Like, the Capitol certainly could treat that withdrawal with, like, no symptoms at all, but, like, you know they wouldn't.
Well, and even if, yeah, no, yeah, you don't want to go cold turkey with that.
No, he would super die. Oh, yeah, so, like, his first kind of official advice is to say, like, do whatever your stylists say, don't resist. Mm. I don't know. It's a whole thing about this book and this series that, like, how you present your body in this world is, like, a matter of life and death.
That's so true about, like, it's definitely a commentary on sort of, like, pretty privilege, kind of, and mm-hmm. and how being attractive can really mean the difference between success and failure. It can mean the difference between life and death. That moment, though, when he, when he says, don't resist your stylist, also speaks to... past experience for Haymitch, for like,
oh my God.
You know, there's been times when he didn't warn them, and like those poor 13-year-olds from District 12 were just like, why are you ripping all of the hair off my body? Stop that, you know, and just like punching a lot of
stylist like tired child coal miners. Like, why are you trying to give me a Brazilian? How will this help me?
And then they arrive.
Yeah. We get to the city, and it's just a really great, cool description of how, like, sleek and colorful and bizarre and surreal and luxurious and scary and weird. And it's just really fun to imagine.
This is a weird comment to make, but I always have issues sort of... There's a dissonance for me between the description of, like, how multicolored all the buildings are in mm-hmm. the Capitol, and they're all like very bright, and because that just does not scream class to me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, so I always imagine things as a little bit more subdued, and certainly like the Capitol we see in the movies is a lot more like
yeah,
like the people dress in crazy colors, but like the buildings are like marble and stone.
They're very metal and stuff. Fashy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's crazy whenever I try to force myself to imagine as it's described, as like you just imagine like a purple skyscraper here and a pink one there. And it's just like, yeah. Gross.
Yeah. No, it definitely, in my imagination, it looks like those like the old like 50s and 60s Superman comics when he shows like Krypton, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I like the moment of well, I don't like it, but the moment where they go through the tunnel, and that's like super uncomfortable for Katniss.
Mm-hmm.
Some good detail.
Yeah,
because it reminds her of how her dad died horribly.
Yeah. And then, like, yeah, they're looking at the people, and Pete is waving, and Cad is looking at him like, what are you doing? And he turns around and is like, I don't know, one of them might be rich. And, like, yeah, I remember earlier you were like, this is the only time that PETA is showing strategy. And PETA, like, immediately tells Katniss super transparently. And Katniss is like, he's a strategic genius and he's out for my blood.
Totally. Like, it's not even really a moment of strategy. He just, like, kind of has one single thought about something, you know? Like, you really imagine him just sort of turning and shrugging, you know? Like, he's just like, I don't know, they might be rich. And, like, but Katniss just fucking runs with it. Like,
Katniss is so prepared for PETA to be, like, really nefarious. And PETA just, like...
PETA's just, like, a cute, nice guy. And Katniss, meanwhile, is like, he's a diabolical mastermind.
It's so good.
this whole passage of, like, he hasn't accepted his death. He is already fighting hard to stay alive. He's just waving out a window. He's literally just waving out a window, Katniss. Yeah, you need to, like, calm down.
It's true.
The boy who gave me the bread is fighting hard to kill me. Relax. Relax.
She has gone so many steps beyond.
PETA's like, look, cool buildings. And Katniss is like, you have crossed the Rubicon now, my friend.
Yeah.
This is a betrayal.
Yes.
Oh, man. So that's the end of the chapter. Any other notes?
No, that's all I got.
Cool. What are you watching these days?
So, I've been reading a bunch of books by the same author, and his name is Ken Follett, and he writes these, like, really long, soapy historical fiction novels.
Yeah, you talked about that last time. Still reading the like, what is it, World War I one?
So, I'm on to the World War II one.
Oh, good. Even saucier.
It has not been as thirsty yet, but also, like, the characters have not, like, grown up quite enough. Now they're kind of, like, starting to be in their late teens, early 20s, so the thirst can happen. But, like, so he kind of just writes the same book every time. And, like, the leading lady, like, romantic heroine always is, like, smart and capable and has, like, beautiful dark hair. And the thing that I love most about, like, what he always decides for his, like, this is what the hot main girl is gonna have, is a huge bush. Like, there is always a moment in these books where, like, our main lady and our main dude are rolling around together, and she's like, I've always been self-conscious about having so much, you know, hair down there. And he's like,
wow.
Why would you be self-conscious? It's hot as shit.
So, like, not even just that they don't shave, it's that they have particularly big bush.
Yes. And I just, like, can't wait to get to, like, where is... I haven't found the bush in this one yet, you know? And, like... I'm sure it will appear.
That's some amazing... I love when men write women's insecurities about their body. It's always very accurate and
always
and realistic.
Yeah, no. So that's... there's that. Have you been watching anything good?
It pretty much happened immediately after we stopped recording our last episode. I just, like, started a binge of sci-fi shows and just have, like, tore through, like, four of them over the past week. So I watched, I watched Star Trek Picard. Mm-hmm. I watched The Mandalorian, finished that up. I watched His Dark Materials, finished up. And now I'm going through The Expanse.
You've been hard at work.
And, like, all four of these are shows that I've watched some or most of before, but never finished, because I'm me. So it's been just a week of me, like, finishing shows that I was already halfway through. But, so yeah, all pretty good. All shows that kind of take a while to build, but, like, really get exciting once you get into them.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Expanse, though, is just, like, there's no levity ever. Like, there's no fun parts. And also The Expanse is, like, a way too realistic portrayal of what space expansion is going to be like when capitalism decides everything about it.
Yeah.
And, like, colonialism and stuff. So it's hard to watch sometimes.
Yeah. The Expanse is really... I watched maybe a couple episodes of the show. Mm-hmm. And I read the first maybe like book and a half.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not funny, and it is very close to home.
No. And like everyone's really hot, but like there's no sexy fun times. Even the sexy times are like straight. Yeah. I don't know.
I was about to say there's no joyful Bush appreciation.
Like, I just keep waiting for, like, when Amos is gonna have a gay lover. Like, I just want that.
That would be glorious. God damn it. That's really, yeah. Another really excellent part of, gay lover was reminding me. Another really excellent part of the book I've been reading is, like, at the beginning, one of the English characters, like, goes and visits some family friends in Germany. Mm-hmm. And they go to, like, you know, Uncle Robert's cafe that he owns with his friend, Jorg, who they live together. But there's a moment when this, like, teenage cishet man character looks around and realizes he's in a gay bar and is like, wait, all of the men are standing together and there's only two women and they both have short hair. But also, like, if you've ever seen pictures of, like, the queer scene in Germany in the 20s and 30s, like, those were the gayest looking people imaginable. They looked really so gay. Oh my god, yeah, you should look up pictures. But, like, the idea that this dude would be sitting in the cafe and being like, oh, this is a nice dining establishment, and, like, several hours in would be like, wait a minute, is the most amazing, like, straight unobservance.
That's great. That's always a fun trope. That just makes me think of... There's an episode, I think it's The Simpsons, and Homer's in... a, like, lesbian bar. Uh-huh. And for, like, the whole time he doesn't mention anything about it until, like, at one point he's like, wait a minute. And he looks around and he's like, there aren't nearly enough fire exits in here.
Good.
Yeah, I just like that.
No, that's amazing. You got anything else?
Nah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to Gay Wizard Book Club. Next week, we'll be talking about chapters 5 and 6 of The Hunger Games. You can reach us by email at gaywizardbookclub@gmail.com or on Instagram and Twitter at gaywizbookclub. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at ray__McLean.
And I'm at Paul W. Turing.
If you'd like to help us out, rate, review, and download us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Goodbye.